Note, Avicenna, 980 to 1037, was an Arabic philosopher and physician who sought to reconcile Islamic doctrine with rational philosophy. He held that God exists above time. End note. In truth, in very truth, the prophet, the authentic one, did not see events coming ahead in time. He saw into the heart, the true being of the reality, saw into depth, not time. He writes about a memory of things which in fact all living men experienced, but none but he remember. That space-time matrix, when replaced with the new one, was accompanied by an analog change in their memories. They all had just lived through the events he described. The prophecies in the Bible describe the far past, the various prophets' pasts. Those events will never come. Those prophets, for some reason, God knows why, remembered how it was before the scenery got whisked away and new scenery whisked in place, and as fast as possible described their visions. God moves through time in retrograde from us, from completion back. We are not moving toward what the prophets, e.g., Book of Revelation, contains. If anything, that was erased and recorded over and left behind. Still, those written documents of prophetic visions are priceless because they give us a fantastically valuable clue to the nature of reality, which is that no space-time matrix is real. It is an idea which God tries out and then abandons if necessary. The visions are the also-rans, not predictions of the eventual winners. God decided against them after trying them out, and synchronized our memories to go with the alterations. I think God trusted these special men, these prophets. He let them remember or see whatever. There was purpose in this, socially speaking, because they could, with great sincerity, forever tell their peoples of the power of God. Also, it was a sort of mercy to those particular men, a genetic kindness to leave these memory traces, because those men knew, as no other men could or would ever know, that the apparent substantiality of their world was an illusion, that God and only God existed, and He could dissolve their world and them at any moment. He allowed these prophets, and probably the ones we know of are only a tiny fraction of the total, to actually perceive in all respects that this is an interval period for us, probably a time of trial or probation, of testing, that the goals and awards and pains and striving and goods and gains of this world are not merely temporary. You can't take it with you. But that reality lies beyond. That the grave is indeed the furrow in which the grains of wheat are sown to grow and blossom into new collective life again, later, of another kind entirely. God showed them that, indeed, this is a play, a stage, a theater, that He lives and loves and is always with us. Somewhere in the libretto of Parsifal, Wagner suggests that the great holy magic which God casts onto the world is a protective veil of enchantment to shield humble, frail, and timid, very mild lives, so that we, being unable to discern them, won't hurt them. He creates the dokos, the veil, as an extending of His protection over them, for they have no other. Only we, the big, crude, cruel, powerful, strong, hurtful creatures, are visible. The veil is not to deceive us, per se, but we must be deceived so that the little ones may live unseen, untroubled by men amidst the shadowy green. The little things of the forest live unseen. The Baki. Each living thing feels impelled to move, to develop or change or grow, but can't locate the source of that urge. From what I saw and understood from 374 on, there is a total plan, the Logos, which superimposes as a vast, static, complete blueprint pattern over a space-time continuum universe, the one we experience empirically, the one our senses tell us about. The superimposition of the Logos plan pattern causes all material reality, this entire space-time universe, to experience a certain stress to be other than it is, a certain urging to become. This abolishes any static quality within the space-time universe. It is compelled to grow by a necessity of its own nature, which is the will of God, or the thinking of God as He conceives the plan. For Him to conceive it is for this stress to be placed on everything in space-time without lapse. It follows that all energies or forces or dynamic fields are manifestations to us of His mind at work. And we are becoming aware that rather than a universe of matter in motion, this is a universe of interacting far-ranging unified fields. That totality of the fields is probably His mind, since I think Him to be immanent in universe, underlying it rather than above or outside it. God is not time. God generates or urges all things into development, that the plan completes itself in continual creation. All we know is that things happen. More accurately, God is the urging forward force within all things, and all things, if things can be spoken of at all, are alive. The ontological matrix is a way in which His urging or thinking is manifested. So in that respect, I think it's not time which moves forward, carrying us with it like a great tide, but that we are driven forward, all of us together, animate and inanimate. Note: a contemplation of God's nature occupies virtually all of Dick's late period work, but as he grapples with theology, what is startling are not the more far-fetched notions. Anyone who has read Dick's earlier work expects these, but the more conventional ones. The God who reveals Himself in Dick's thinking often is very much the familiar humanized Judeo-Christian God. This God acts personally and responds personally in the ways of both the Old and New Testaments. Note a few paragraphs earlier, in a passage that is practically biblical, the trust that Dick's God places in special men and prophets. The upcoming reference to God Jesus as Zebra is first deeply curious, then forehead-smackingly obvious, and fabulous anyway. Nothing is more indicative of just how unconventional Dick's mind is than that his most conventional notions seem most unconventional of all. Sometimes consciously and sometimes unconsciously, Dick tries to reconcile his own particular God teased out of the fabric of reality and time with the God of millennia, worshipped by millions. Which is to say that consciously and unconsciously, herein Dick is finding his place in civilization. S.E. End note. If there is a universe of antimatter, there may be a universe of anti-time, which would be retrograde time, or rather, elements moving retrograde to the matter, ourselves, which move forward in time. Thus, time symmetry would be achieved this way. I saw this retrograde entity in late 374. Normally, we see it blended with forward-moving elements such as ourselves. At the height of my mystic experience, which is to say my extremely heightened perception of reality, I saw my environment decline in intensity, whereas at the same time, I felt an inner self, my entelechy, I suppose, I didn't have the concept then, grow dynamically. The balance shifted more and more from outer to inner, which could be regarded as psychologically withdrawing my projections from external reality and regaining them and their energy within my own total self. At the peak of this, I experienced myself as very real and moving through virtually non-existing things, which had become so vitiated and dim that I supposed, and maybe accurately, although it was so astonishing that I drew back from this implication, that all non-living objects around me literally drew their lives, their existences, from me and from other living entities. We animated them, yes, but animated what? What is meant by them when this animating energy is withdrawn? Mere signaling systems to inform me of sequential whens, a series of signals in specific order, arranged in order to release changes in me. Time, properly understood, is merely an awareness of the procession of these little weak cueing signs. Their advance as we encounter them. But they do not move. They are pattern arranged, and we advance forward, up the manifold, from one to the next and the next. There is really nothing in them but minimal, economic transfer of information that one particular now has replaced the now or prior signal before it. We advance from signal to signal. The signals are unmoving, totally inert. We are driven inexorably. None of us can halt himself in that motion from signal to signal, since each one of the signals carries with it transfer information to last until the next. Each hands us over, as it were, when its now has expired. There is no way you or I can refuse to receive the next signal, to keep from encountering it. And it is this inexorable but invisible metaphysical but real momentum which we call time. It's the same as destiny. It is the end or completion of our entelechy. Reaching back retrograde-wise through the system of signals and dragging each of us bodily forward to meet that end, that completion. This unitary organism, which we call reality or the universe, is most itself, most there, most alive at completion. And since there is no time or time force, then it's there now drawing us toward it. We move, it stands still. Being more than the sum of all its parts, how can anyone or even all of its parts resist it? How can the totality, the absolute pattern, be weaker or smaller than anything else? It would be like saying that before being assembled, the parts which go to make up a kit are somehow more effective that way, scattered about the living room rug, unconnected and unrelated to each other, not functioning at all, except in terms of the template or diagram which the workman is pondering, which accompanied them. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and surely the whole exerts a greater influence on those parts than they do mutually on one another or on it, or each on itself. This must be why Parmenides understood that no matter how many parts he saw, how much diversity and change his senses reported, reality had to consist of a one which was unchanging. His sense saw those parts coming together to form that one, but the one he knew a priori and by the most rigorous reasoning, must already be. It did not lie ahead along a timeline somewhere in the future. It ontologically lay beyond or behind or deeper within the many, now and forever. The pressure of time driving all the pieces to come together into the complete pattern is a sort of voice calling to them, a summoning to return. Everything has already been there, since this lay outside time. Anamnesis was a memory not of the past, of former time, but of ontology, outside of time, of already complete then, now, later, a memory of all time unified. This memory stretched in all directions in time, and finally into none, into being itself, into the heart which is alive. Empedocles supposed it to have been in the past because he remembered it. But if time is cyclic, he remembered the future just as well, logically speaking. Empedocles didn't actually remember having once been divine. He remembered that he was divine, would be divine. Here, verb forms mislead us. This is mere semantics. To remember immortality is to remember outside of time. Long ago, I lived forever. I knew everything and could not die, and I was perfection itself. But somehow, something went wrong. I forgot. I'm down here. Anamnesis could be said to be memory of the future restored, even memory of the present. He remembered what he was. He remembers what he is. He remembers what he will be. This recollection has nothing to do with the continuum of space-time. Memory is not a function of time, but of comprehension. Memory is to know. Forgetfulness is to fail to know. I remember equals I realize or I understand. Also, I remember, anamnesis equals I become, being, which equals I am changed. Paul, look, I tell you a sacred secret. We shall not all fall asleep, i.e., lie fallow in the idios, cosmos, in ignorance, but we shall all be changed in an instant, etc. Metamorphosis.